Hi, Greg. I'm really glad to have you with me. Welcome to Forbidden Conversations. Not so forbidden, like somewhat forbidden. I recently had a censorship strike on YouTube where they said, you know, we're gonna they took one of my videos down, and people said, well, what did you expect? You titled it Forbidden Conversations. But I was able to actually, submit an appeal. You're a lawyer. An appeal. You're supposed to know these words. Help me out here.
Appeal. I mean, like
the Greg. Come on. Yes, an appeal. And you just froze at me on appeal. Did I lose you?
What's going on with that?
Oh, okay. I got you back, I think. But you are freezing. Okay. I think you're back with me.
What just happened?
You froze, and then I think you're like, you seem to be freezing, but I think you're okay now.
What the hell? Okay, sorry. The internet here has actually been really quite good.
So maybe it's the censorship gods. They're coming after us.
Yeah.
But yeah, I got my appeal. I won my appeal, so I'm really excited. And I don't even have a law degree, nor do I claim to have one, like most people on the internet.
What was the particular? What was your sin?
So the sin was I had a conversation with someone who she had a COVID related injury, but hers was like documented, because I'm pretty careful about talking about stuff like that, like without, you know, because there's a lot of people making all sorts of claims. But in that case, it was a personal experience, and it was somebody who had a documented, you know, official record of this stuff. And so, you know, so it did get me a little bit riled up that would be taken off, and it didn't violate any. I read through their list. It didn't violate anything. But it might be just, you know, I think what's happening is that the AI technology, like maybe somebody did complain or something happened, or maybe the AI flagged it and based on a keyword or something, and then they're overzealous. But that is a problem, because I think we're going to see more and more of that as we go on. So this stuff is actually going to get more complicated, because it's going to be easier for technology to sort of, it's not even going to be humans kind of sorting this stuff out. It's really machines that are doing this for the most part at this point, right?
Yeah. And the AI, you know, particularly as you start getting into like ChatGPT and artificial intelligence, I'm worried that we're going to get every bias that I've fought in higher education sort of baked into our censorship regime, even right down to our, you know, little robot friends.
Right. Because also, what are they, where are they taking that information from? Right. So they are taking it from their,
they're learning it in a bad part of town, man.
Yeah. Right. They're hanging in the wrong parts of town.
They're learning their habits in higher ed. And that's, you know, like, that's,
well, you know, you are the president of FHIR. So, you know, I think not everyone is familiar with FHIR does. And I know recently FHIR, yet, exactly, which I love what FHIR is doing, and particularly because it's a nonpartisan organization. And, you know,
people have pointed out, one of my employees is doing a speech at Princeton, and people showed up to like shout her down. And instead they just did some heckling, which is fine. But pointing out people on our staff who are conservative, and we're like, hold on, we're really proud of that. Like the fact that, like, look at all the other people who aren't. You're going to see Greenpeace in there. You're going to see PETA in there working with someone who worked at the Alliance Defending Freedom. You know, like, that's a point of pride with us, that we actually, because otherwise, like, particularly in like the fundraising sphere, I get a little frustrated sometimes, because people will refer to organizations as being nonpartisan, particularly more left-leaning foundations, where I know for a fact not a single person who's even mildly right of center works there. And I'm like, if you actually want to be a nonpartisan organization and stay that way, you have to have actual political diversity among your staff.
Yeah, well, and most organizations, they'll either, you know, lean one way or the other, and they just don't.
It's a lot easier to do that.
It is like, a lot easier.
If staff agree with each other politically, you know, like it tends to be more homogenous. You can just play to whatever side. I make this joke all the time. Like if I decided to make fire, you know, like just a strictly partisan in either direction, you know, 10 years ago, we would have been a $100 million organization. We went the much harder way, which is being willing to say goodbye to owners and, you know, lose employees if they don't get that we really mean it on the free speech thing.
Yeah, and you really do take on cases that I think represent, you know, both, you know, regardless of where the offense is coming from, it doesn't matter which side, which is what I love, because to me, it's always been about the principle of it rather than, you know, I don't care which side it is. Yeah. And that is the key. But, you know, I think a lot of people do have a tendency to sort of, you know, fight for it when it represents their interests and not care very much when it doesn't. It's like, okay, well, too bad for you. Ha ha. You did it to us. And therefore now you deserve a taste of your own medicine, which is unfortunately what I'm seeing a lot of that happening in the discourse.
Well, and that's why, you know, like there are a couple pieces I should cover. You know, for the audience that doesn't know FIRE, we were founded in 1999 by a left-leaning libertarian named Harvey Silverglade. You know, like friends with the Beat Poets guy who lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts, got pictures of him and Allen Ginsberg on his wall, kind of like, you know, just great old-fashioned, badass ACLU civil liberties guy. And he's the one who found me out when I was living out in San Francisco. And then on the other side of it, we have absolutely off the charts brilliant scholar of the Enlightenment, Alan Charles Kors, who is a professor emeritus now at University of Pennsylvania, and he's probably the world's, you know, biggest expert on Voltaire, you know, the, you know, famously misattributed, you know, "I will fight to the death to defend your opinion," which was actually a summary of what he said that was coined by someone else in 1910. But anyway, they founded FIRE in 1999 because they saw something bad going on in higher ed, that essentially it went from, you know, free speech movement beginning in 1964, incredibly successful, the campus free speech movement in Berkeley beginning in 64. By 1974, they'd won overwhelmingly in the Supreme Court in four different decisions about academic freedom and freedom of speech from 1957 to 1973. You really got tremendous victory, both for professor free speech and academic freedom rights and for students. And fast forward just 10 more years in the future, and universities are already passing speech codes. And they flat out called them speech codes to ban speech that was deemed to be offensive, to be racist, to be sexist, which, I mean, I'm left-leaning myself, and that sounded, well, certainly we don't want people being racist or sexist. Then when you start looking into it, you realize it's like, it can be basically any opinion you disagree with can be, you know, called up on this stuff. And that there was a big flash of this madness from about 1985 to 1995. And these codes were defeated in court. Left and right thought PC on campus was ridiculous. And everybody thought it sort of ended in 95 with the defeat of the Stanford speech code, actually just two years before I got there, in 1995. But unfortunately, most of my career has been more or less saying, guys, it's like actually quietly getting worse on campus. The professors aren't as into it. And thankfully, we had a nice long period where the students were great on freedom of speech. But it's not a healthy environment. People are getting in trouble because administrators are enforcing these rules that were created. And the speech codes actually increased in number, even though they were being defeated in court.
So what was driving it? The administration, specifically the code, like the codes, the rules that existed, and the administrators putting that into force?
Yeah. So the administrators became sort of like the foot soldiers, the true believers in the right not to be offended. They also had, you know, the peace and quiet of the university in mind. So sometimes when, you know, like one of my favorite, I feel weird calling it one of my favorite cases, And it's sort of the star of my 2012 book, my very first book, called Unlearning Liberty. And in that book, it opens up talking about the story of Hayden Barnes. And this guy is he's a nice, Shambhala Buddhist kid. He's a decorated EMT, and he's a passionate environmentalist. And he starts picking on the president of the university at Valdosta State University in Southern Georgia, public university bound by the First Amendment, who keeps on going on about how this parking garage program is going to be his legacy, that essentially when he retires, like this beautiful big parking garage is going to be his legacy. And Hayden thinks there's more environmentally friendly ways to do this. So he protests, gets called into the president's office, gets dressed down by the president, and then goes back to his room and makes a collage on Facebook with like no blood for oil and pictures of like bulldozers and that kind of stuff. And he named it the SAVE, which was an environmentalist group at Valdosta State University that he thought had fallen down to the job, / Zachariah Memorial Parking Garage, a joke about this being part of his legacy. And the university tried to claim that that was a threat upon the university president's life, because memorials usually happen when people are dead. So this hippie kid was going to kill him. So we litigated this, and with the great Bob Corn Revere, one of the great First Amendment attorneys out there. But it's a perfect example of how sometimes it's not even all that ideological. It's, I don't like you, and I'm going to figure out the excuse to get you. And of course, as the case went on, it just looked worse and worse for the president. Basically, everybody around him was like, dude, you can't just make something up and kick this kid out. It was really funny to see how consistent the advice to him was, don't do this. So it ended up being nearly $1 million settlement in that case.
Oh, wow.
So the administrators kept it alive for a long time, but then something very bad happened right around 2014. You started having students hitting campus who, rather than rolled their eyes at the administrators, kind of agreed that some people should be censored, or lots of people should be censored. And that's the stage we're in to this day, is that there are students who are much more free speech critical, oftentimes working either with the, being ignored by, but also often facilitated by administrators. And it's made the worst period for free speech on campus I've ever seen in my 23 years.
So I'm trying to figure that out, because for me, like when I went to school, what was the question? Sorry,
when and where?
Well, I went in Canada and I studied communication. You never heard? Yeah, I mean, people like to blame it for a lot of things. Like Robin Williams blamed it for everything. People like to blame it for the smoke right now. So some people want to build a wall to keep us out. I hear, but it is like a little country next to the U.S. So you might, if you look at a map, I think you might be able to spot us.
Did you go to McGill?
No.
I just really like McGill.
I'm just trying not to dox myself. but I went to a university in Canada, and very left-leaning university. Okay, and I studied communication. But freedom of speech was a very like essential, fundamental thing, and it was hammered into our heads. That was the thing. And so when I started seeing these changes, so that would have been like the 2000s, And so when I started seeing these changes, it was just quite shocking to me. And what I hear from people, though, to this day is like, because I still think to some extent people won't say out loud, oh, freedom of speech is bad. But what they'll say is, oh, no, I support freedom of speech. I believe in freedom of speech, but, hate speech is bad,
yes.
Right? And I get it. I mean, it's not like I'm like, okay, hate speech is wonderful. I don't think hate speech is a good thing. But, you know, the problem when we are getting, when we get into, you know, is defining hate speech, of course. And that's where, you know, that becomes a fundamental issue. That's why, you know, in the US, and you have different laws in the US than, you know, in this country that you've just discovered called Canada. Where we are not as free in that regard, and there's some laws that are, you know, threatening to be passed to further limit speech. And in Ireland right now, you know, they're going through some really intense threats to freedom of speech. But it's interesting to me that people are so willing to sort of say, yeah, we support freedom of speech, but and what is it, do you think, that has sort of shifted in particular where, because before I what I saw, especially on the left, was like this willingness to say, no, I support freedom of speech, absolutely, even if it means that people are going to use it to say some despicable things that I will not like, and maybe I'll just stand up to that, but you know, but I don't like it, but I'll allow it. Because that's the price. But now it's changed. So what do you think that caused that shift in your view?
Well, I co-authored a book, Coddling of the American Mind, with my friend
you
Jonathan
sure
Haidt, which came
very
out in 2018.
Influential book, yeah.
Making the argument that when I first explained it at FIRE back in 2014, I got crickets because they thought it was such a weird argument. But that the same habits that were threatening freedom of speech on campus would also make the people who have those same sort of intellectual mental habits profoundly anxious and depressed. because, you know, I've had my own struggles, and cognitive behavioral therapy is something that saved me. And all of what CBT is, I mean, please forgive that I'm going to oversimplify this to everyone who knows a lot about it. But I do highly recommend studying it because it's helpful no matter what. But it's mostly getting in the habit of talking back to your more exaggerated thoughts. You're catastrophizing in your head when you're thinking that you can read people's minds. You know, that when what I mean by that is like you go on a date and you just leave it thinking that person absolutely hated me. You know, might be true, but you don't actually know that. Fortune telling, you know, is that we're all doomed. Catastrophizing, binary thinking, things are either perfect or we're doomed. All these kind of things that you try to get in the habit of talking back to those voices in your head that say things are terrible, but not with power of positive thinking, with going, okay, do I actually know that? Using rationality. And when you get in the habit of that, it's not so much that you go into the power of positive thinking mode, it just the anxiety and depression goes down because the volume of the scariness, anxiety, catastrophizing, what are called cognitive distortions in your head quiets down a little bit. And what I was saying was these seems to be students who are told that they're in constant danger, that they're basically in a war of good versus evil, that they're being told by people who claim to be nice to them that they can't really handle life on their own, that they're much more fragile than we have any scientific reason to believe they actually are. All these things that they get dressed up like nice, compassionate things to tell people, but when you put them together, they're kind of a formula for profoundly anxious, depressed people who also are hostile to freedom of speech. So when we saw that coming, we wrote the original article in 2015 for The Atlantic. And I was joking, and we solved the problem. but no, it just actually everything got much, much worse on campus. And so we wrote the book in 2018, thinking maybe we'd missed the worst part of it. And that we were too slow in writing it when it came out in 2018, because 2017 was such a bad year for free speech, particularly on campus. And things got so much worse. 2020 was the worst year. And I'm going to use a term that I don't particularly like all that much, but I've decided to keep the rest of the population in the conversation. You almost have a moral obligation to use it. cancel culture. The phenomena of people, and my definition is very, very simple, and it's an historical one, that it's the uptick after 2014 of people, you know, losing their careers, losing their, getting kicked out of school, getting fired, getting expelled, having their books, censored. The big uptick in that happened, those kind of successful campaigns beginning around 2014.
Do you think that's tied into social media in large part? Yeah, because that's weaponized. Yeah.
I think that there's no other good stand-in explanation for why so much of this focalizes in basically two different years. When you look at, you know Martin Gurry's work?
Not so familiar, no.
He wrote a book called Revolt of the Public, and it talks about how, you know, the first kind of wave of social media having a disruptive effect that was really global was in 2011. And you saw that on campus in the United States to a smaller degree. You saw the Occupy Wall Street movement in the United States, but you also saw big movements in Israel and Spain. And of course, the biggest thing was the Arab Spring. And that was really enabled by social media. So there was this little eruption of, whoa, this is a truly disruptive technology in 2011. Kids who had sort of grown up in that environment started hitting campus in large enough numbers that some of the phenomena that they were used to, coming up through K-12 with, you know, cell phones in their pockets and social media everywhere, started hitting campus. And that's when you end up with cancel culture, because cancel culture is basically like, people are always kind of like, oh, but cancel culture has always existed, has been a response I always get. I'm like, well, that's like saying the Red Scare always existed, as far as I'm concerned. I'm talking about a very particular, if you're saying that people get in trouble for what they say, no kidding, I'm a First Amendment lawyer. But there was something very different about what began around 2014 and really sped up around 2017. And so canceling of the American mind is first trying to establish, and this comes out October 17th, canceling of the American mind. Oh, and my co-author, by the way, 23-year-old genius, Ricky Schlott. You should have her on your show. She's amazing. She's great. We're a really good team because I'm an overwriter. And she can like take my, 5,000 words and turn it into a good paragraph that actually says it better than I did. So we're a very good team. And it's also nice, since so much of Coddling the American Mind was focused around the problems faced by young women, to actually be working with a Gen Z woman on some of these problems. Anyway, so task number one of canceling is just to show this is real. This is on a scale that we're going to be studying in 100 years. And the people who try to say that isn't true just don't understand history or the history of censorship, or, well, actually, honestly, mostly it's just a knee-jerk reaction because they don't want it to be true. So let's look at the numbers around professors. By the time the book comes out, we will almost certainly have exceeded 1,000 attempts to get professors fired since 2014. About 60% of those result in them getting punished and investigated in some way, like something, but the attempts are what matter, because that shows how hostile the environment is. And when you compare it to the previous decade, I mean, it's like there's like a tenth of that number.
Well, and the attempts alone have a silencing effect, right? Because if you know that there is a chance even that you're going to have that experience, you're going to be careful with your words. So that's a silencing, chilling effect on speech. Exactly. So that's a huge impact when you're talking about, intellectual thought.
Yeah, and I mean, just the actual unpleasantness of being targeted in one of these campaigns is pretty awful.
I know.
Yeah, I'm sure you've had this experience. I certainly have. But when you look at the firings, I think by the time the book comes out, given the rate that we're currently at, it'll probably be around 180 professors fired just since 2014. So it's a 9-year period. And it's there's nothing that you can compare that to in terms of professors getting fired. Because like I actually mentioned earlier that like the American law was established on campus beginning in 57 and ending around 73. The only thing you can compare that to in terms of scale was McCarthyism, But McCarthyism, the law wasn't established yet. All of McCarthyism was prior to 1957. In fact, the end of McCarthyism is considered to be that decision that I mentioned that established academic freedom means you can't just fire professors for their political opinions, which wasn't established prior to 57. McCarthyism is usually considered the 11-year period from 47 to 57. And that period, basically most experts say it was about 100 professors got fired. There is some research that indicates it might be more like 150. And even then, we're talking about 180 professors getting fired in the schools that we have good information on, which is, by the way, a tiny sliver of like the top 400 schools you're ever going to hear about anything about in the media. There's basically about 80% of four-year students attend only about 600 schools. There are people who like to be like, there's 4,000 schools. It's like, yes, a lot of these don't. First of all, we don't know what happens in a lot of these more technical and specialized schools. And second of all, that's not where most students attend, you know. Anyway, so when you look at the polling, you know, I think we had something like 30% of professors saying they've been told by administrators that they can't, that they should avoid controversial research. 16% of professors saying they've either been threatened with or actually investigated by the university for their research or pedagogy. Those are numbers that there's no meaningful comparison, even when you go back to the Red Scare. During the Red Scare, when they polled professors, I think this was a poll from like 1954, how many of you are changing what you write or watering down what you write because of the current environment? 9% of them said that. Now, depending on like which polling question, it's more like 90% of professors say this. And here's a lovely test, and you'll appreciate this more than most. I explained this, and you know, when I got like a particularly hostile kind of like response to even just using the term cancel culture and then explaining it. And then I'll get like, well, maybe all these guys had it coming and something culture. And then I mentioned, you know, that about 40% of these, 35 to 40% of these are of professors getting fired is coming from the right, right? This is coming from Turning Point USA. This is coming from some of the conservative media targeting professors, sometimes they're saying some pretty obnoxious stuff, you know, about dying police officers, but at the same time, absolutely protected. And nonetheless, and we defend them in all of these cases and oftentimes win. And when I watch someone suddenly take the issue a little bit more seriously, like when I was having a conversation in San Francisco and we mentioned that we defended Nicole Hannah Jones and her situation at USC with this very ferocious critic who thought he had any idea about typical Silicon Valley guy, didn't know anything about the topic, but was sure he knew what was actually happening. But as soon as we said that, suddenly we got this kind of like, oh, you know, they're taking us very much more seriously. And I was like, and guess what? I now take you not seriously at all, because you shouldn't have cared whose ox is being gored. When you found out that maybe you might agree with some of these people, suddenly it's a real issue.
It's so true. And the thing is, so when I first kind of, you know, started being more engaged with these things, I mean, a lot of the canceling, I was seeing a lot of that happening on the left, and I saw the right sort of being taking on the mantle of free speech and being anti-cancel. And then I was seeing the same behaviors happening on the right as well. And when I talk to people on the right about it, they're sort of in this denial phase about it. And they're like, no, we don't have any power. We're not doing this. It's only the left. And I get attacked a lot. And I just find it really frustrating, because to me, it comes down to just its behavior. Doesn't matter who does the behavior. And everyone's just like points fingers at each other like kids, because really it's what children do. No, he did it. And I'm like, so you don't care about principles is what you're telling me, because it's about the principles. So I'm like, well, you did this to us first. And I'm like, so what? Right.
Yeah.
And now you're mad because we're fighting back. No, I'm not mad because you're fighting back. I'm mad because you're doing this to people. And yeah. I don't care what side you're on. I care that you're doing this to people. And And that's why I think it's so important to, you know, to stand up for those principles, because that's what matters. Because the impulse to censor, the impulse to control, to cancel somebody that you don't like or don't agree with, or whatever that motivation
is,
that's
older than the species.
Exactly. And everyone has it. Now, the difference, I remember I was rehearsing a play, and it was, I wish I remembered the name of the play right now, but it was Audrey Hepburn was in it. And I forget the other actress, but it was an interesting play. It was kind of about cancel culture in a way. It was set in, you know, the olden days, but it was about these two women, you know, and one of them was actually, I guess she was gay, but it was just about the rumor, you know, they were just really close friends, and the rumor comes out. One of them gets accused of being, the two of them get accused of being gay, but one of them, I think, is, she ends up, it's really tragic, but the idea, you know,
an Audrey Hepburn play that I have no idea which one it is.
Yeah, and it was actually, it was a movie, and it was quite a big deal at the time, because not everyone would show this, and it was pretty controversial. But yeah, the idea in the play was like, you know, at some point they're thinking about moving, right? Because if they move to a new town, maybe that won't follow them, because back then there is no social media, right? And now the idea of moving to a new town, that's not going to help you, because you have this digital footprint. And it's the same whether you're, you know, we talked about academia, because you can track maybe these numbers a little bit better. It's really hard to track some of this stuff when it comes to employment. And that's something that people talk about a lot as well, where it's like, okay, well, I'm going to my job. I'm doing my job well. You know, I'm not talking about these things at my job. I'm not expressing my views at my job, but, you know, maybe after my job, and then people might be getting fired for their views. I know that has happened. I've even interviewed somebody on this podcast who this is, you know, she talked about, she worked at Levi's, and, you know, and it was, and it was, Jennifer Tsai.
In the book we talk about various industries, we have a chapter on COVID related cancellations, and Jennifer figures fairly prominently in that. And meanwhile, the big difference between Jennifer Tsai and everybody else who got canceled in that crazy 2020 year was they offered her $1 million to sign the NDA, you know, and everybody else, when they're getting canceled, signs the NDA, and they hope it goes away, and it oftentimes does, because you're not allowed to talk about it anymore. And she was like, no, I couldn't live my life not being able to talk about this. So even, and it's funny, because people also who want to claim this isn't even happening, which is just silly and irresponsible at this point, you know, you point out the numbers of professors, you know, give some stats on students, for example, the fact that everyone's saying that, then you go to polling where everybody's, you know, giving numbers about being afraid to state their opinion, unlike we've seen, doesn't matter, that doesn't count. And then when it comes to the people being fired from corporations, people are like, oh, you can only point out, like, you know, a handful of examples of that. I'm like, you can find hundreds easily. Like, and we found hundreds easily. We know, but that one is actually just scratching the surface, because most of these get handled by, you know, I think it's time for you to sign the NDA, sir, or maybe it's time for you to find another job. You're never going to hear about most of these. So thanks to Jennifer for actually being willing to say all that stuff publicly.
Well, absolutely. I mean, one of the reasons that I even started speaking out about this kind of stuff, because I was in a situation where I made it go away. Well, I did have a situation where, you know, I had the cancel culture after me. and,
you're the Washington Post, right?
No, it was, I have written, for them, but it was actually, I ended up writing a story about it for Newsweek at the time. It was my first op-ed that I'd ever written. It was about that topic. And, because, you know, I had a group that was after me, you know, the cancellation by social media, to keep things brief. But essentially, like, in my situation, I could have probably kept things pretty quiet, you know, after a while. I could have kind of gone the quiet way, saved myself a lot of trouble at a certain point. But I was getting all these messages from people who have experienced the same things, sometimes even worse. And at a certain point, I felt like I owed it to them to use my voice to express this. And so I started, you know, because some of the cases that I was hearing about were just so atrocious. It just didn't seem right. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to burn it all to the ground. I thought I was going to lose everything, to be honest. And I thought, okay, you know, worst case scenario, I'm not going to have a career anymore. I'm going to open a coffee shop with my savings. Like, that's where I was. That's where my mind was at. Like, maybe I'll do that. That's like my, you know, backup plan.
Sounds kind of nice.
It doesn't sound horrible, but not to be able to do the thing you love to do kind of sucks too, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, and being ostracized by everyone, not so pleasant. To have people write how much they hate you, not pleasant. Being doxxed, also not pleasant. People are not used to it. It's not a normal experience to go through. You know, I think now that I have been through it, I realize, you know, I've learned a lot. I think I can guide people through it. I feel stronger, different. I realized what a ridiculous thing it was in some ways for people to go after someone over what they did. But at the same time, it was, it's just not normal. And the magnitude of like a mob going after an individual is just insane. But, you know, but when you choose to sort of stand up to them, you're also, you know, there is a choice element to that where, you know, you could kind of go into the sunset, you know, and disappear. And in some ways, you know, becoming part of the conversation is also a choice, at least that I've made, right? So I take some responsibility over that, I think.
I just feel lucky that I had my mental breakdown about what wasn't yet cancel culture way back in 2007. I think that helped a lot because it is exhausting. And I talk about in the book about, you know, a conservative friend of mine who killed himself, you know, after being canceled back in 2020. And he always gave off this like vibe of being hyper confident, you know.
Yeah.
So I should know better because like when I'm, you know, I was pretty good at hiding it myself when I was in a really bad way. Although the thing you can, my friends could tell is if I stop cracking jokes, I'm in trouble. So he got canceled at University of North Carolina, Wilmington. He was a conservative who had a lot of fun poking at the left. Like that was his style, kind of in your face, but it was very jokey. He was mad about lockdowns, so he tweeted on Twitter, lockdowns just got temporarily halted, we're all having beers, you know, at a bar. I forget what the name of the governor was, but Massa governor, please let my people go. And and that was it. Like that was the
and
one.
And that was it.
Yeah.
Wow. Over that.
And it's funny because he frankly said more offensive things over his career. But that was, you know, at the time that people were looking for scalps. And he was so confident that when I heard that he was targeted, Fire was overwhelmed with requests for help. We did not know what to do with it with ourselves for a couple of days there because we were like, we don't have enough people to handle this many cases. It was unlike something we'd ever seen. We got as many cases in July as we would in June of 2020, as we would in an entire year when we were smaller. And so I thought I could, you know, check in with him when I caught up with all those other cases and talked. And it wasn't until late July when he'd already signed his, you know, agreement and seemed everything was over and there wasn't much we could do. You know, I talked to him on the phone. Apparently people were still coming after him. People were like going to his house and stuff, you know. People were calling him on the phone and saying that, you know, they saw his wife and kids filleting black men at BLM protests, which, you know, he didn't have, this is one of the things he told me, you know, on our relatively short phone message, phone call. And, you know, I was like, man, I've never heard Mike in that bad shape before. And the next week he killed himself. And he's not the only one that I've seen who've been in these things that end up eventually killing themselves. He's just the one that it was closest in time. You know, like it was kind of the but for situation. So it's
no, and I've seen so many people destroyed by it, or yeah. You know, I have definitely heard of other people have committed suicide. You don't realize, like for me, one thing is I was so cautious about not appearing like I'm a victim in any way, yeah. That I almost like overplayed my strength at the time. So, yeah. And everything I did was like, I'm going to like fix everything. So I started all these projects, like I'm going to fix this and I'm going to do this and this. And it was only later where I realized how much it was actually like very traumatic to go through that. And even when I say that, there's like this pang of guilt. Oh, I can't say that because that's a victim-y, you know? And to this day that I feel that way. And that's why I'm like really cautious to even talk about it. Yeah. And it's strange. So, there was this sense of like wanting to just fix everything for everyone. I started these media literacy things and I wanted to advocate for everyone who's ever gone through this. And it was just, I realized I can't undertake everything, but it was like a way of coping with my own, I guess, my own trauma. But it's a weird thing to go through as an individual. And I was an individual who's never been in a public sphere at that point. Like I wasn't someone who was doing any public speaking. I was never even a journalist who wrote personal opinions before. You know, I only started doing that after that happened. Up to then, in many ways, I was someone whose voice was pretty silenced. But I think it made me realize how awful that was, and how we were living in such a restrained and how dangerous that was to restrict people's voices to the extent that they were. The only way to kind of fight back with that was just to speak. And it was a slow process to sort of get to the point of kind of unleashing and freeing one's voice. But it's so fundamentally important. And if you don't set an example, you know, I think the way that I felt was key to deal with it is to kind of set an example and model that and by doing it myself, as opposed to just, you know, lashing out at people, you know.
Yeah.
But this is, you know, you're also like all your books are, I noticed, The State of the American Mind, you know, The Coddling of the American Mind, and your new book, The Canceling of the American Mind. You seem to be very obsessed with the American mind.
completely by accident. I guess my concern about the American mind is accurate. Just the formulation of the title, I'm just stuck with it. I originally called my title that I went into the 2015 article with, and really wanted it to be this. It's a boring title, but it's more accurate to what my point is. It was called Arguing Towards Misery, which was essentially the idea that if you have these cognitive distortions in your head, it's kind of like convincing yourself to be anxious and depressed, and that we're actually, rather than telling young people, don't do this. And this is where I always say, this is what makes me angry about it. A lot of times I feel like we're teaching kids cognitive distortions out of bad mental habits or out of, you know, compassion, misplaced compassion that's not very well thought out. But in other cases, we're doing it under the idea that if I make you feel really scared, really guilty, under threat, it's going to produce some kind of positive social outcome that usually the person instilling it would prefer, like whether that's, you know, to go out and solve global warming or to fix police brutality or all these kind of things. And it's a bad model for social change because depressed and anxious people oftentimes don't have the best picture of what will actually help anything. And a lot of times they just get depressed and anxious. Like it doesn't actually produce the change that you want in the world. It can produce actually a great deal of hopelessness and nihilism is more what comes from anxiety and depression. So I wanted to call it Arguing Towards Misery, back to the title. Got stuck with Coddling of the American Mind, a title I hated in 2020.
Oh, really?
I hated it. And because I'm like, we're not, people are going to see coddling and they're going to think we're saying kids are spoiled. And that's not the point of what we're saying. I'm not saying that they're spoiled. I'm saying that we're teaching them the mental habits of anxious and depressed people. It's a compassionate point, not a scolding point.
Yeah.
Then when we went to, we got the book contract, we got the book contract under the title Disempowered. Also does a better job of getting across what I'm trying to say, which is we're taking, basically we've got to do this cartoon at some point. Someone's standing, someone's standing at the top of a Olympic, you know, diving board at the Olympics. And her mother, climbs up the stairs, you know, behind her, just to get up to her and top, whisper into her. It's like, honey, I love you so much. And know that you can't really do this on your own. And you're going to be very humiliated. And you're never really going to recover from that. I love you. All and right. then goes back down. Because, like, that's what I feel like we're doing. And I want to be clear. These are oftentimes some of the, like, best and brightest kids out there who are being disempowered by the advice they're being given by K-12 teachers, by parents, that sounds compassionate, but when you think it through, actually is really quite toxic, really quite harmful. And so I was like, in no way in hell is this book going to be called Coddling of the American Mind. And then at the last minute, the publisher was like, yep, all the booksellers are saying this has to be called Coddling of the American Mind.
Oh my gosh.
So I was like, It was like, okay, so we're not going to publish the book. And so we put in a section where we said, where we explained, this is how we can live with the title, is just saying we're using coddling in terms of how overprotection can actually harm. You know, like that's all we mean by it. Still don't love it, but I can live with it under that. I also don't like the fact that people think that we're referring back to Closing of the American Mind, a very, like, an underappreciated book, like actually a quite rich and intellectual book that was critical of what was going on in higher ed back in the 80s, but there's no relationship between these two books. And so why Canceling the American Mind? Because I'm stuck with a formula, so why not? I've been joking.
It's the sequel, trequel. Yeah.
Yeah. Is that I want to do Gerunding of the American Mind. But the when it comes to my concern with the American Mind, though, that does get me to a point I really want to make. And one of the reasons why book left me like, oh boy, this problem is a lot deeper than I even thought, and I live in it all day. The people we have been canceling, at least the ones we know we have the best data on, are overwhelmingly people in the expert class. They are professors, they are researchers, they are sometimes students, and it's for having the wrong opinion, for publishing the wrong paper. A lot of times it's for saying something oftentimes kind of mildly offensive on social media. And that's a much bigger problem than people get, because when people see that, you know, like let's take Carol Hooven at Harvard. She got a whole, department angry at her and wanting to get her canceled at Harvard because she argued that biological sex is real on Fox News. You know, biological sex is real. And this became something
point. Yeah.
Yeah. Where the chief diversity officer sent an email to everybody talking about, you know, this being offensive. And then, and she ended up getting forced out of Harvard, at least for a bit, because her, nobody would be her TA for her class. And she needed a TA for her class, because she said something that is, sorry, that biological sex is real. Thankfully, Steve Pinker, you know, who's on our advisory council, gave her a position where she's working to this day. But here's the thing. When people know that you can get your life upended, your career destroyed for saying things that sound to the rest of the American public as kind of obvious, minor, you know, points, they don't trust experts after that, because they know that, like, if someone's saying something, if an expert's presenting something that's completely with sort of like a more left-leaning narrative, they have every reason to be suspicious of it, because it's in an environment that's extremely politically homogenous. Higher ed's never been as politically homogenous as it is today. You can get punished at multiple stages. I call it the conformity gauntlet for having the wrong opinion. You won't get tenure if you're considered too risky or too free of a thinker. You have to worry about cancel culture. You have to worry about bias-related incident programs, which are a really pernicious influence. You probably won't get past the diversity, equity, inclusion statement. It doesn't matter what your race is if you have the wrong opinion. Those are really more political litmus tests than anything else. And under those circumstances, why should they trust experts? Because
they haven't been scrutinized at all.
Well, they've been scrutinized to make sure that they comply. It creates a perverse situation, by the way. It creates a perverse situation where if it's a counter narrative piece of research, people are going to assume it's more reliable because that's more like a statement against interests. People were gunning for you. It's like what happened to Roland Fryer, you know, who did some research on the homicide rate, for example, at Harvard. He did some of the research that I believe showed that it's the number of unarmed Black men who are shot is not as disproportionate to the number of unarmed white men who are shot as is sometimes thought. However, just like Steve Pinker, my takeaway from it is looking at his numbers, oh my God, we shoot way too many people in this country. That should have been the major takeaway. But it didn't perfectly conform with people's ideas what it should be. And next thing you know, he's being investigated in this case for harassment. And that's a little bit of a tough one because they tried to find something I don't know if he actually did any of this, but that's something but I've seen that accusation abused to just go after speech so many times. People saying that they're harassed by someone saying something offensive in class or online for that matter. I've seen that my entire career. And so I think that this is devastating to people's trust in experts. I think it makes the ability to have shared facts under the current system very, very hard.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's interesting to me that you're also approaching this not so much from a political perspective, but much more a psychological perspective, which is probably much closer to the truth of it, where it's well, I at least my bias says so, where it's like, okay, there's something inherently happening to people where they're less comfortable with their views perhaps being challenged with being uncomfortable. Like, I always bring this back where I'm like, okay, I've always been fairly comfortable speaking with all sorts of people and having my views challenged because, like, around the dinner table, we have sheer chaos. And my views are always put down and I've been called all sorts of things by my family. You know, like, we just have very different points of views all the time and we argue and it's just like normal. And, you know, that's okay.
There's another word for that. Healthy.
healthy dysfunctional family.
Yeah, absolutely.
In some ways,
my family has got all sorts of dysfunctions, but we are pretty arguing with each other and not getting mad.
Like, yeah, well, we get mad. We get mad. Like, and you know, it's interesting. I'm pretty good at keeping.
We do a good job of maybe it's like the Britishness. Yeah,
it's the British.
My mom's British.
Eastern European Jewish, like, so like we're not
really
good at
weird combo.
Yeah, we're not. My family gets very. I'm the more calm person, but even then, like they even trigger me. Like I've lost my. There's nobody. Like I'm very calm, and too calm almost in debates and conversations. Like I probably drive people crazy because I don't react. But when it comes to family, that's the one time I get, because they know how to push my buttons. They really do. They go for the really personal stuff. But at the same time, we're like, it's not an option to not like have family dinner the next week. It's just not. So, so you figure it out, you know, and it's okay. You can have a different point of view. And also people change. Like there are certain things where, and I've seen like people in my family change their points of views, even points of views where I thought like, this is a terror. Like I really hated that this person thought that, and, you know, and yet they're capable of change too. And so I think, and I've changed, you know, so I think being aware of that really helps kind of look at things from a different perspective. And I'm curious to understand. The other thing is, like, I'm always curious to understand, okay, why does that person think the way they do?
Yeah.
So that's why I'm like, okay, even somebody who I very strongly might disagree with, I'm like, okay, but I have that curiosity as to why that person believes what they believe versus somebody else who just feels really triggered by their beliefs, yeah. You know, triggered. And it's interesting to me why people respond in these like very emotional ways, but maybe I'm a little autistic. I don't know. Cause I just don't have that really deeply emotional response. So sometimes it's hard for me to like quite understand why people do respond in these like very, very emotional ways.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, for me, having a good curiosity about everything human is kind of where we should all be to a degree, you know, because it's like, you know, why you think that. And even if you think that person is dead wrong, knowing that they think that and probably that other people think that is absolutely crucial information to understand the world in which you actually live. So I point this out when people argue about there should be no free speech for, you know, conspiracy theories. And it's kind of like, so that just means that nobody will tell you that they have a conspiracy theory if they think that you're plugged in. And by the way, never do that to people who believe in conspiracy theories. Like, if people believe that there's a conspiracy to shut them up, do absolutely nothing that looks like a conspiracy to shut them up. That will only make it worse. Meanwhile,
yes.
conspiracies do happen to some degree. Usually small scale, you eventually comes out, you know, Michael Shermer's written about this. But at the same time, conspiracy theories change the world usually for the worse. You know, like, so like the old protocols of Elders of Zion, you know, like the idea that kind of like there's a secret Jewish, you know,
I'm well aware.
Yeah. Controlling the whole world.
Yeah, I'm part of it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
What should I ask for? Knowing that people believe this is incredibly important to understanding history. Like, you're missing something major about what happened in the early 20th century without understanding the kind of paranoia and lies that people were spreading. And the idea that kind of like you're better off not knowing about it, it's like, oh yeah, so you're just better off plugging your ears and making sure you know less about what the world actually looks like. That doesn't make you safer. That actually makes you less safe. It is much safer to know what people really think and why than to pretend they all think nice things.
And sometimes engaging with them, like, I mean, I had somebody that I engaged with fairly recently, who was one of the believers in that, such a thing. And, you know, it's like, it's kind of weird. And I don't think everyone has a responsibility to engage with someone like that. But at the same time, it's like, if you can, sometimes it can lead to unexpected results, because they might think that, you know, maybe somebody, if everyone who's Jewish is evil and, you know, horrible to engage with. And then if you kill them with kindness, that unexpected result might kind of shake their worldview. Maybe little by little, it's not going to happen overnight, but that might challenge their, you know, vision of the world, as opposed to me just like attacking them, for example, and saying, oh, you're a racist. So I think sometimes having those interactions can be sort of valuable, but you know, they don't necessarily scale. So that's a problem and a whole other discussion. I mean, I also think a lot about, okay, like who do you platform and how do you, you know, I mean, I don't believe in shutting down anybody's ability to have speech, but like if you have an event or you have a show or a podcast or something like that, at what point, you know, being considerate of who you bring on or who you have a conversation and how do you approach that conversation, I think even more importantly. I think those are things that are a little more complex because I don't think that everyone necessarily, you know, you know, for example, I use this situation. For example, if I had Hitler on as a guest, you know, mm-hmm. and we talked about art, I would consider that to be highly irresponsible, right?
Yeah.
But is there a world, a situation in which, you know, having someone like Hitler on, but having a different kind of conversation, is there a value there? Maybe there is a situation where, you know, I'm very well informed and there's a particular pushback and I'm trying to reveal something. Maybe there is, but maybe if I did it badly, or, you know, there's a potentially terrible consequence to that. So I don't know all the answers to that.
Yeah, there's an interesting story that just reminded me of. A couple of years back, Steve Bannon was supposed to do the New Yorker Festival in New York City, and there was going to be a tough interview, you know, from maybe Jeffrey Goldberg or something like that, a fancy tough interviewer to talk about, you know, Trump and talk about the new right and all this kind of stuff, and then celebrities, you know, of course, start saying, I'm not going to have anything to do with this. And Steve Bannon is speaking there. And I got invited on Smirconish to talk about it, about why they shouldn't have canceled him. As much as I may, you know, I'm not a supporter of Bannon or of Trump. And one of the best examples that was given in response was someone saying, it's like, well, what if they had someone from the Taliban? What if they had someone who was there, who'd been, you know, part of the Taliban, who was there to interview? What would you think then? I'm like, I would tune into that interview in a heartbeat. I would absolutely want to know, like, what does this look like from your perspective? It's not because you think the person is good. A lot of times you want to hear from the person because you think the person is bad. And sometimes it's much more important to know what bad person think and why, because sometimes you're lucky enough to discover some of it's misunderstandings. Some of it are problems that you might not have fully appreciated are really problems. And then when it's like the paranoid, you know, things that you might think is a lie, it's still also important to know that.
I just think it needs to be done, you know, responsibly. And when I say responsibly, I think like the person who's doing the interview has to be well informed and push back on the ideas or challenge them or ask the right questions, in the sense of like they don't have to like disagree, but at least they need to clarify the thoughts enough of the other person that we come to have like a good understanding. And if they're saying nonsense, that needs to be challenged in the moment, so that we can like, so they are not spewing things in the moment without any clarification. So I think that to me is like sort of responsible, as opposed to, so if I'm completely uninformed and I'm inviting someone from the Taliban to just purely speak and say nothing, I don't think that I'm doing a good job. But if I'm really well prepared, I don't have to agree with the thoughts. That looks like something different. And if I'm only doing the interview just for the, you know, for the glory, you know, just to get clickbait, and there is no value at all to it, I think that's irresponsible. So I think you have to be really intentional before you do it, is kind of my view on that.
All agreed. So unfortunately, I have to kind of wrap up a little bit.
So I've really enjoyed having you on, but tell us how you can find your book. And I know it comes out in October, so I know you mentioned that earlier, but
three quick things. I just found out while I was on this that if you have students who listen to your podcast, American students, or actually I think Canadian students as well, we just confirmed that Lara Bazelon is going to be joining Camille Foster and Michael Monahan from the Fifth Column. And they're going to be doing a live broadcast from our summer student conference in about 2 or 3 weeks. And also that means people are going to be able to listen to it on Twitter. It's going to be awesome. I love those guys. So that's a cool thing I just found out like while we were talking.
Great.
FIRE, you know, we just expanded the Foundation for Individual Rights and Expression. So we now fight for free speech off campus as well. We've got lots of really cool cases there. We're on Twitter, we're on Facebook. We even try to produce a little bit of comedy, which makes me anxious, even though I'm compulsively joking myself. I don't make a lot of jokes like in my work life. And lastly, I got a book called Canceling of the American Mind, you know, coming out on October 17th. There'll be more about it actually at thefire.org. And, you know, one of the things that I'm really excited about in the book is we talk about cancel culture as a way of winning arguments without winning arguments, and point out all these ridiculous ways we have to not actually to avoid addressing the substance of what someone's actually saying. And I want people to just start calling that out more, that essentially like, nope, that's actually, no, that's a logical fallacy. That's identity based. That's like, let's actually have the argument if we're going to have the argument, or just stop pretending. So anyway, I really appreciate chatting with you.
I really appreciate chatting with you as well. Well, thanks so much. And I will make sure your bio and everything is going to be linked as well, but really great to have you on. And I look forward to reading your book as well.
Absolutely. Take care.
Thanks.